Welcome to the second season of the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm Chase Maxwell. Twenty-two years ago, the Friends began a storytelling series for adults. What could be better than sitting by the fire, sipping a warm cup of coffee or cider, while listening to some of the best writers Minnesota has to offer? Over the years, the Fireside series has featured a great range of authors, from Kate DiCamillo to Jack Weatherford, Carol Bly to Marlon James, making the winter just that much more bearable. The 2016 season continues this great legacy of presenting Minnesota's best authors reading by the fire. After a great response last year, we've decided to continue podcasting the series in its entirety. In the past 50 years, Asian Americans have helped change the face of America and are now the fastest growing group in the United States. But as award-winning historian Erica Lee reminds us, Asian Americans also have deep roots in the country. Lee joins the Fireside series to discuss her new book, The Making of Asian America, which explores the little-known history of Asian Americans and their role in American life, from the arrival of the first Asians in the Americas to the present day. Published to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the passage of the United States Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965 that has remade our nation of immigrants, this is a new and definitive history of Asian Americans. But more than that, it is a new way of understanding America itself, its complicated histories of race and immigration, and its place in the world today. Lee is the granddaughter of Chinese immigrants who entered the United States through both Angel Island and Ellis Island. She grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area and received her PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. She teaches history at the University of Minnesota, where she is also the Rudolph J. Vicoli Chair in Immigration History and Director of the Immigration History Research Center. And now, Erica Lee.
Thank you so much for coming out on this chilly night to this warm, inviting venue. I gather that the fireplace gets a little warm over time, so it might be a little too warm for me, but I'm really pleased to be here. I love being surrounded by books, especially children's books, because I just kind of want to curl up in one of those beanbags and read some of the books that I might have missed over the past few years. My kids are They're a little bit too old for some of the picture books, but they look so good. So I'm going to read a little bit from this book. It's over 500 pages, so I'm not going to read all of it. And it covers centuries and continents. I'm going to pull out a couple threads that I hope will give you a little bit of an illumination on this really rich and complicated communities that we call Asian America. So I'm going to set the stage. I'm going to read from a chapter called Chinese Immigrants in Search of Gold Mountain, and I'm going to read from a chapter in my own family's history. And I'm going to set the stage. It's California. It's 1848. Does anyone know what happened in California in 1848 that would have been important to our nation's history and global history? The Gold Rush. So gold is discovered in the foothills along the American River in Northern California, and gold seekers from around the world rush in to California. Among the thousands of gold seekers who flocked to California was a man named Moy Dong Ki. He was my great-great-great-grandfather on my mother's side. He arrived in San Francisco in 1854 as a 20-year-old married father from a village named Sunjak Milun Village in the Pearl River Delta of southern China. He left his wife and his two sons behind while chasing dreams of Gumsan, which is what the Cantonese called Gold Mountain and the United States. By the time he made it to California, there was little gold left in the foothills, but he stayed anyway. We don't know much about what he did in these early years. When he shows up the first time in official U.S. records some 45 years later, it's in an affidavit filed with the U.S. Bureau of Immigration stating his intention to travel to China and return to the United States. This type of paperwork was required only of Chinese immigrants. So beginning in 1882, the United States passed the infamous now Chinese Exclusion Act. It barred all Chinese laborers from entering the United States, which is the vast majority of Chinese peasants in the world at that time, and allowed only certain exempt classes to even apply for admission. And there was a class-based bias to this, as well as a sort of a diplomatic bias to this too. So the only exempt classes were merchants, because we wanted to continue to trade with China, teachers, students, travelers, and diplomats. The Chinese American community protested vehemently against these laws, challenged the constitutionality of these laws in the highest court, but the laws were found to be constitutional. However, their protests did open up a few avenues for other types of Chinese immigrants to apply for admission, and that included the wives and children of merchants, and also the wives and children of U.S.-born Chinese American citizens. But all Chinese in the United States were under strict surveillance, and my great-great-great-grandfather found that he needed to fill out a number of government forms, subject himself to interrogations and investigations, and provide affidavits from two white witnesses who vouched for him and his status as a merchant whenever he left or reentered the country. So to bring two Chinese witnesses along to the U.S. Bureau of Immigration was not acceptable. It was believed that they would just lie on your behalf, but the whites would not lie. His 1899 application was filed in New York City, where he had been a resident and merchant for some 20 years. It seems that he had followed the growing number of Chinese fleeing the anti-Chinese movement in the West, heading for better opportunities and perhaps friendlier neighborhoods in the East Coast. He opened a store called the Yuet Sing and Company at number 10 Chatham Square in New York City's Chinatown in 1882. He then moved it to number 6 Mott Street a few years later. By the 1890s, he had another store in Philadelphia's Chinatown and had opened the Kwong Wah Tai and Company at number 14 Mott Street. So for those of you who know a little bit about New York City, Chatham Square and Mott Street still remain the center of New York City's Chinatown. And they must have been amongst the earliest Chinese businesses there at that time. His bilingual business card identified the company as importers and dealers in Chinese groceries and also general merchandise. So in the book, I have an illustration of the business card, and that's him from 1891. But like many Chinese immigrants during this time, Moi Dong Kee's life stretched across the Pacific. He's rooted in the U.S., in Philadelphia and New York City, but his family remained in Sunjak Milun Village, and he traveled back and forth to China at least 3 times over his 45-year sojourn in the United States before he retired in the village where he was born. He passed on his business to his oldest son, Moi Kwangshi, who continued the Trans-Pacific shuttle between China and the United States, leaving his wife and children in China while running the family business in New York and Philadelphia, and adopting the name of John Moi. By 1907, my great-grandfather, Moi Hua Cheng, entered the United States. And with him, this transnational family pattern that the Moi family had practiced for 3 generations eventually broke. In 1911, he married a woman named Yun Si, and a daughter named Sao Bik, my grandmother, was born in 1912. A son named Chong Man followed in 1918. The next year, so 1919, my great-grandfather decided to settle in the United States permanently and became Raymond Moi. So he's a Chinese merchant, and as a Chinese merchant under the Chinese exclusion laws, he is allowed to enter and re-enter the United States as long as he brings the 2 white witnesses along, and he's eligible to bring his wife and his children to the United States. But in order to establish a pathway for them to come, he needs to verify their existence with the U.S. government. So he's filing the necessary paperwork with the U.S. government to sponsor them into the country. But when it comes down to it, Raymond lists his wife, Yuan Si, and 2 sons. One is Chong Man. The other turns out to be his nephew, a boy named Chong Dan. My grandmother is never mentioned in this paperwork, and according to the records of the U.S. Bureau of Immigration, she does not exist. If she does not exist, she does not have a pathway into the United States. Chang Dan, given her immigration slot, came to the United States in her place. My grandmother remained in Canton with her grandparents and attended school. There are many reasons why my great-grandfather might have made the decision to leave his daughter behind in China. Perhaps he believed that boys were more likely to find steady work and contribute to the family economy. Maybe there was no other way for Chang Dan to immigrate, and giving him the immigration slot was great-grandfather's way of performing some act of filial duty. Perhaps he thought it was safer for my grandmother to remain in China. Whatever the reasons, his actions effectively excluded my grandmother from the United States. She would never see her mother alive again, and she would not be able to immigrate herself until 1933, when she married my grandfather, Hui Bingji, or Ben Hui, a merchant and restaurant owner in New York City. So these Chinese exclusion laws were doubly discriminatory because Chinese women, in particular, mostly did not fall under those categories of merchant, and this is 19th, early 20th century China, merchant, student, teacher, traveler, or diplomat, right? So the only entryway for Chinese women to come is as a dependent to a father or a husband. And of course, that husband and a father, or husband or father, had to claim you, and then your right to remain in the country also was dependent on their, not only their immigrant status, but also whether they stayed married to you or what have you. So for Chinese women, it was especially difficult time period. So this is a family mystery for us. And this is all family history that was hard won. It is only because I'm a trained historian and did that hard archival research that I found these details. My grandmother herself never talked about this time period. It was too bitter. There was too much resentment. There was too much sadness, anger, a sense of abandonment that you just knew that you were not supposed to ask Popua about how she came to the United States. And I've always wondered, since looking at these records and realizing and seeing the testimony, great-grandfather saying to the U.S. immigration officials, how many, you know, are you married? Yes. How many children do you have? Do you have any daughters? No. Do you have any sons? Yes, too. She's literally written out of the historical record. And so I've always wondered who's this guy that took her place? Was he really a nephew? What was the situation? What's the deal? So one of the privileges of writing a book and getting the opportunity to talk with audiences is that you get to meet a lot of people. And 2 weeks ago, I was in LA at another public library giving another talk about the book. And a few days before I went to LA, I got an email message in my inbox saying, "Hello, I am Chang Dan's daughter. Would you have time to meet with me?" And at first I thought, Chang Dan's daughter. But then I thought, well, of course. You know, let's talk, and I'll bring the immigration file. And who was he? What happened? What's his story? And we don't know all the answers. We spent a nice evening, you know, talking about family history. We don't know all the answers still. But it seems that Chang Dan and my grandmother were, you know, almost born at the same time, September of 1911. And the immigration officials tracked these births and did the math, you know, so carefully that unless they were twins, and that's unless he claimed twins, right? He could not claim both. And it's still not clear why Chang Dan couldn't come to the United States on his own. His own father was in the United States. Probably we know that he worked as a laundryman. Laundrymen are not merchants. The vast majority of Chinese cannot work in any other field at this time except for laundries and as restaurant cooks. Those are not merchants, so perhaps that was the deal. It seems that Chang Dan's father was also an older brother to my great-grandfather, so there might have been some, you know, family arrangement. But he knew what happened. He knew what was happening. He knew how he came to the United States. And in his later years when he was telling this story to his own children. You know, he burst into tears. He said he felt so badly. You know, he was so glad that my grandmother eventually was able to come. But these are the costs. These are the consequences. These are the costs of unfair, discriminatory immigration laws that separate families, that make families make these draconian choices that have consequences for, you know, for generations. So we're chipping away a little bit at that family mystery and family history, but it's an ongoing story. So my grandmother comes to the United States, and once in New York, she and my grandfather start new lives. They have three daughters. My grandfather ran two successful restaurants in Brooklyn. One was named the New Deal Chow Mein Inn. So Chinese immigrants could not become naturalized citizens. They were not white, and by law, they were ineligible to become naturalized citizens. But I'd like to think that I know which way my grandfather would have voted by the name of the restaurant. It catered to a mostly Jewish clientele in the Brighton Beach neighborhood, nicknamed Little Odessa. Apparently, Neil Sedaka was a big fan of the restaurant. Those of you who are younger than me will not know who Neil Sedaka is. But those of you who are older than me will probably remember. The restaurant was a family affair. My grandmother ran the business side of things, and many of the cooks came from my grandfather's home village in China. My grandmother wore these beautiful, elegant cheongsams and welcomed people into the restaurant. My mother and her sisters made egg rolls after school, earning a penny apiece. Dishes at the New Deal included lobster Cantonese, chicken chop suey, and New Deal lo mein. I'm not sure how New Deal lo mein differed from non-New Deal lo mein, but there was also the New Deal wontons that became locally famous and were remembered years later in a cookbook featuring New York City's great culinary traditions. By the 1930s, my mother and aunts attended public school in Brooklyn, went off to college, and grew up identifying as Americans first, Chinese second. This is World War II, this is the 1950s. The emphasis on immigrants were to assimilate at almost all costs. So after four generations of immigrating back and forth between China and the United States, my family was finally becoming Chinese American. So I wanted to start with this family history because it offers a window into the experiences of many Asian Americans before World War II. The Moyes were just one family out of a massive migration of Asians around the world, but to the United States, a little under a million came before World War II. The largest group were Chinese, 450,000 Chinese came to the United States. They were followed by Japanese immigrants, around 380,000. Filipinos were the next largest, 150,000. And then smaller numbers, around 8,000 each of Koreans and South Asians. And the stories of their immigrant dreams, just like so many immigrants who came during this time period, but also the realities, the American realities that they faced, is the story of the making of Asian America before World War II. But I also wanted to start with this family history because this search for, you know, my search for my family's history was also a search for where do Asian Americans fit into American history in general. So much of it had been lost to me that Americans first, Chinese second meant that we didn't grow up talking a lot about, you know, how did we come and what was life like. You were supposed to forget about those old times. I tell my kids, you know, that the emphasis for their grandparents' generation was so much on Americanization that I actually don't know how to celebrate Chinese New Year, which is happening right now, because, you know, the way that we would have celebrated it is different than what is quote-unquote authentic, perhaps. But the other problem has been that Asian American history has just been so hidden and invisible in American history generally, that it took a dual search. So I remember very explicitly the moment when I had this, you know, they call it that light bulb moment, but I was a college student. I was in a summer school class, taking a class in California history, something that I had, you know, learned throughout primary, middle, and high school, and I thought I knew it. Turns out that the water polo coach that taught high school history wasn't all such, you know, such a good teacher after all, because I finally started learning about all these things that I had never heard about. And the one that stuck out the most in my mind was this thing called the anti-Chinese movement, how Chinese were driven, literally driven out of small towns and big cities, Seattle, Tacoma, San Francisco, violently harassed. The largest mass lynching in the United States happened targeting Chinese immigrants in 1871 in LA. And time after time, I kept on thinking, I've never heard of this. I come from a Chinese American family with long roots in the US. I'm studying history, American history, I've never heard this. This is the first time that I'm learning about these things. And then I would go on, oh, what about the Filipino farm worker experience? But you know, I didn't know Japanese American incarceration was, you know, so large scale. So time after time, all of these subjects kept on popping in my head about, you know, things that had been missing in my own education, but also were largely invisible in standard narratives of immigration and American history. And I then started asking, well, why? You know, why haven't I heard this before? Where is this history? And why are Asian Americans invisible? So a lot has changed since then. There are a number of organizations, nonprofit groups, award-winning documentaries, books, national historic landmarks that honor, preserve many aspects of Asian American history and explain why Asian Americans are important to American history. More and more of us are spreading the message that you can't teach American history without Asian Americans. But despite this progress, I find that most Americans still know little about Asian Americans, their long history in the United States, and why they've been so central to many of the major social, political, economic transformations in the United States. I see this in my own classrooms. Every semester, I will teach some aspect of Asian American history in whatever course I'm teaching, and my students will come up to me and say, I never heard this. I never knew about this. And at first I thought, yeah, you know, we're still early in the phase of teaching, you know, Asian American history. But over the years, it's been consistent. And it's not just at the University of Minnesota. I can be talking to students at Ivy League universities on the East Coast, or public school teachers coming from the South, or New York City docents, and consistently I get the same message. I've never heard about this before. So I wrote this book in large part to try and, in a small way, fix this problem of writing Asian Americans back into American history. And it's more important now than it has ever been before. Recent news reports predict that, well, show for that for some groups, Asian immigrants are the largest groups coming into the United States now. Chinese are the single largest immigrant group coming into the United States. And that in the future, they're going to be surpassing Hispanics as the largest immigrant group as well. There's about 20 million Asian Americans in the United States now, about 6% of the population. They're considered the fastest growing group because from 2000 to 2010, they increased by size by 46%. And they're part of America's transformation into a majority minority country by 2044. As we know here, you know, they're settling in places that have traditionally welcomed immigrants like New York City, San Francisco, Boston, LA, but they're spreading out across the United States, Atlanta, Las Vegas, Houston, Phoenix, Minneapolis, St. Paul. But Asian America, if there is such a thing, is extremely diverse. And what I want to do tonight is share with you a few stories that highlight this great diversity and pull out a couple of themes that I think are especially important. So the first one is that the history of Asian immigration highlights the U.S.'s complicated relationship to immigration. So one of the ways in which we describe ourselves, the United States is a nation of immigrants, and that's supposed to be a very positive perception, right? Positive stereotype. That means that we've welcomed immigrants, that our country is built on immigration, that immigrants built America. But if you take any of a certain political party's stances on immigration today, one would question whether the United States still wants to be a nation of immigrants. So the truth is we've actually had an extremely complicated relationship with immigration. Asian immigrants in the late 19th, early 20th century were literally recruited, you know, with labor recruiters going into villages in the Punjab region of present-day India and Pakistan, and to the villages in the Philippines and China and Japan, and bombarding people with tales of the United States, easy money to be made in the Hawaiian plantations if you just want to purchase this steamship ticket that I fortunately just have right here in my back pocket. But quickly, we have also turned towards restriction and surveillance, rejection, deportation, and repatriation. So I'm a teacher, and usually when I talk, I like to show images to help and historical documents and photographs to help illuminate some of the things I'm talking about. But I was told that technology is that kind of technology is not possible right here. So I did the old school handouts. So what I'd like to do is, and I don't have one for everyone, but I'd like to pass them out, and if you could just, you know, take one, pass them around and take a look, and then just make sure that people in the back can see them as well. But one aspect, and I should probably hold on to one of them so I can thank you, remember what I'm talking about. One of the aspects of America's complicated relationship to immigration is how we both admit immigrants, we screen, we choose them. Our immigration laws dictate, you know, who we want to let in and who we don't. And those laws have often been based on national origin, class, the type of skills you have, the connections that you have, et cetera. And the challenge is, you know, how do we choose those immigrants once they come to the United States? So the first images that I wanted to show you is of the immigration station at Angel Island. This is the quote-unquote Ellis Island of the West. It's in San Francisco Bay. If you're ever in San Francisco, take a tour of the immigration station. It's a National Historic Landmark now. About 1 million immigrants entered through Angel Island, so a much smaller number than the 12 million that came through Ellis Island. But it's here because it was built directly in response to the Asian exclusion laws that you have the swinging of the door open and closing much more dramatically than you have in Ellis Island, which as an Atlantic port of entry, mostly built to process European immigrants who did not face the same draconian restrictions as Asians, had a different, more mediated experience. So on Angel Island, the gates certainly did open for those who are of elite class status, who had family already here, who could prove to immigration officials that they were worthy immigrants. You could prove that you were a worthy immigrant for the Chinese, through extensive interrogations that could last all day. Those immigration files that I'm talking about from my family's history, some of them are inches thick, that track immigrants' every movement, even going into Chinatown, into Chinese communities, and doing investigations about, you know, where do they really work? They say they're a student. Are they in school right now? Interviews with witnesses and so forth. You know, we have a lot of news reports about immigrant detention today growing by record numbers, you know, 430,000 in detention at any given time now. This history begins on Angel Island because this is the first time that we have, the processing for immigrants took so long that the government felt they had to hold those immigrants until that processing was complete. So sometimes it was a day. The longest detention is close to 3 years. Extremely crowded conditions. And they were kept in these conditions for 23 out of 24 hours of the day for Chinese immigrant men. invasive medical procedures that were very different and very new for Chinese immigrants, and not something that they were used to as well. So Angel Island represents, on one hand, the extreme of America's closed doors to Asian immigrants. But let's fast forward a bit and consider how Asian immigrants have also benefited from America's immigration policies. And I chose this example in particular because it's close to home. We go through some massive changes, in immigration policy after World War II and certainly during the Civil Rights Movement. And one group that is benefiting from these changes are Southeast Asian refugees. This is a U.S. policy of humanitarianism, of compassion. We feel, and President Ford makes it very clear, that this is a moral duty. So as the war is ending, well, after the war is ending, we help to evacuate 130,000 South Vietnamese alone from April to December of 1975. Okay, so let me repeat that. April to December of 1975, a very short time period, we evacuate 130,000 South Vietnamese. This is unprecedented for us. We have no refugee programs in place. There's no International Institute or Lutheran Social Services or Catholic Charities that already have programs in place. They do now, but at that time, we did not. So when we are listening to these debates today about how the U.S. has accepted 2,347 Syrian refugees, but how it's a big deal when President Obama suggests that we boost that number to 10,000, I like to remind people that we did this before on a massive scale. And they were followed by 1.2 million others from Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia over the next decades. So the photographs here, this is of a group of students here in St. Paul. It's at the Lao Family Association. They're learning English. This is early 1980s. This is it's easy. It's Mimua, the first Hmong American elected to state senate. She came as a refugee herself. And does anyone recognize who this is? I'm going to look over to my younger, to Psycho Lee. So he is also, he's considered 1.5 generation born in the refugee camps of Thailand, a well-known social activist, hip-hop artist, spoken word artist. And he's appearing here with his grandmother. They combine their styles in a group called Fresh Traditions. So the history of Southeast Asian refugee resettlement is one of, certainly there was what we call compassion fatigue over many years, but this is a story of how the doors have opened to Asian immigrants too. So a complicated relationship to immigration. The other aspect that I wanted to talk about is how the history of Asian Americans is also the history of how race works in the United States. So I'm explicitly saying it this way. I'm not saying about how the races get along, but how the ways in which we identify people as certain races and how those certain races have certain abilities and certain proclivities, how that and how Asian Americans has figured into that illuminates how race works more broadly speaking. So for example, and this has been shifting. For Asian Americans, it is often shifting, and it depends a lot on what's happening in the United States, but also internationally. So if we think back to the early 19th century, up through World War II, I have some blank pieces. Asian Americans had more in common with African Americans than they did with whites. They were considered unfit for U.S. citizenship, inferior, inassimilable. Many of the laws prevented them from testifying against whites, from marrying whites. There was segregation. There were unequal economic opportunities. Asians couldn't become naturalized citizens. So the image on the left here is a great example of the anti-Chinese sentiment and the public attitudes around Chinese immigration. They're cheap labor, they're gonna monopolize all of the white jobs, they're racially inferior, they're sneaky, they're devilish, and they're just strange. They're in foreign dress, they've got the weird hairstyle. If you saw this in color, he would be colored yellow, like bright yellow. And I was laughing because some of our politicians look orange to me. But that's not considered like a racial trait. So this image is one that examined the coming threat of Chinese immigrants. This is very common. However, things change. And it has a lot to do with, again, what role do Asian Americans play in what's going on in the United States, the domestic message that we want to tell, but also the international message that we want to tell. So then the image on the right is published in Time magazine, December 22nd, 1941. This is 2 weeks after the attack on Pearl Harbor. The United States is in a quandary. We are going to become allies with China in the fight against Japan. But we face a little bit of a hypocritical situation because we want to say, China, we understand you, we are on your side. We just don't want any of you to come to the United States because we think that you're inferior and inassimilable and all these other problems. So President Roosevelt is very keen on changing the public rhetoric around Chinese immigration specifically because now we are allies with China. And Madame Chiang Kai-shek comes on a goodwill tour of the United States in 1943, and she's received so well. But the American public needs a little bit of convincing. And so magazines like Time and Life publish these very helpful columns. And this one specifically says, first of all, please forget all of the things that we said for many, many decades, how the Chinese are just like the Japanese, and you can't tell them apart, and then the Koreans and the Filipinos and South Asians, they're also immigrant threats. Now, what we want to impart upon you is that the Chinese are actually the good ones. We still don't like the Japanese, but the Chinese are the good ones. And so we want to tell you or give you some hints about how to tell your Chinese friends from the Japs. And so there's some cute racial rules here. Japanese, except for wrestlers, are seldom fat. They often dry up and grow lean as they age. The Chinese often put on weight, particularly if they are prosperous in China. Chinese are not as hairy as Japanese and seldom grow an impressive mustache. And my favorite one is most Chinese avoid horn-rimmed spectacles. So we see a dramatic shift happening in World War II, mostly on the wings of international pressure. The Chinese become our friends. We now cherish the Filipino fighters who are fighting alongside us and suffered under Japanese occupation. The Indians aren't so bad either. They are allies with us as well. It's the Japanese that we still need to be concerned about. So we see the divergence of how different Asian ethnic groups become racialized as either friends or enemies, but we also see how much international relations plays a role in this situation. So this one is always a surprise for people to see. So this is from Dr. Seuss. I know, right? He was actually pretty racist. His World War II cartoons are pretty bad. And this one's called Waiting for the Signal from Home. And in this cartoon, he's portraying Japanese immigrants, Japanese Americans, as one indistinguishable mass, westernized on the outside, all wearing suits and hats, and they look respectable, but the message is you just can't tell what's going on inside, that they're likely disloyal inside. And there's this endless mass coming all the way up the Pacific coast, so it's an unending stream. The scary thing is that they're already here. Not only did Japan strike us from the air, but the real threat is all of these Japanese Americans already here in the United States. And they are lining up to grab their bars of TNT, and they're waiting for the signal from home. So this idea that Japanese are, as a race, disloyal, cannot be trusted, and a danger, willing to do harm to the United States, is the mainstay, the main rationale for the forced removal and incarceration of 120,000 Japanese Americans. Two-thirds of them are American citizens. Most are children in elementary school. The other ways in which Asian Americans have been used to highlight race relations or highlight how race works in the United States is in comparison to other racial minorities. So right now, the most common stereotype of Asian Americans, educationally, achieving, economically successful, they're called the what kind of minority? The model minority. This is the most broad and pervasive stereotype of Asian Americans that has been rooted in the Chinese friend model, but also has exploded in the 1960s. And the reason why is because once you have made Asian Americans acceptable as friends, then it's an easy next step to use them in this ongoing discussion about, is there really systemic racial discrimination and institutionalized racism in the United States or not? And so during the 1960s, as the civil rights movement turns from civil rights to more radical black power, to moving from voting rights and an end to segregation to more radical calls to dismantle the system altogether, you have a lot more news pundits calling out and saying, not so fast. If the system is so unequal, then how do you explain the success of the Asian Americans? They suffered a lot of discrimination, but they're not protesting in the streets. They're quiet. They're putting their nose to the grindstone. They're working hard. They respect their parents. They respect authority. They make it work. And if they can make it work, then this delegitimizes and discounts, right, the calls for radical change. And so beginning in the 1960s, you have the beginnings of the idea of the Asian American model minority, which grows ever stronger in the 1980s. This is from Time magazine. This is pretty much what my sisters and I looked like in the 1980s, with the big glasses. But it continues to today. This is an op-ed from Nick Kristof in the New York Times, talking about the so-called Asian advantage. And he explains it by looking at how it must be Asian, traditional Asian cultural values. Asian cultural values based on Confucianism, which I wouldn't be able to tell you. I myself wouldn't be able to tell you what those are. So one of the challenges here is how this has become so pervasive that it obscures the longer history that all those other images show, the longer history of discrimination, the present discrimination that some Asian American groups still face. It also masks how not all Asian Americans are making it, are economically achieving high perfect SAT scores and out-whiting the whites. What's important is for us to consider both the commonalities of the Asian American experience, but also the diversity. And so this is just a table that shows the educational attainment that disaggregates the data for Asian Americans. And you'll see that for some groups, there is a high percentage of groups who have a postgraduate degree. So Asian Indian, Sri Lankan, Chinese, Malay, Bangladeshi, Pakistani, Korean, Indonesian. And then you have a high proportion of groups who have less than a high school education. So the diversity here is really important. And by calling all Asian Americans a model minority, you miss this. And it has real consequences. And I can see that at places like the University of Minnesota, where, say, the student services for mentorship, retention, et cetera, for Asian Americans is not as much paid attention to as it is for other groups, because the idea is that they're all making it and that everything is fine. The other thing that this mass is that many Asian immigrants today already come with graduate degrees, because this is the only way to come into the United States today: family reunification or professional and technical skills. And those with professional and technical skills, so for example, South Asians have 30% of the H-1B visas. They already have the college degrees. So this has nothing to do with how America is a economic balancer or a economic, you know, mobility is still working. It's more about how we highly select certain immigrants. So Asian Americans, while they might be often overlooked in how we think about America past and present, I argue that they have such an important role to play in many of our contemporary debates because they have witnessed, they've experienced, they've been part of both the limits as well as the possibilities of America. So I'm going to read from the closing paragraphs as we close our session today. There are a wide variety of Asian American voices now being heard from Tiger Mom Amy Chua. Does anyone remember who she is? She's the author of Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mom, right? And her message is that there's a strict Chinese way of parenting and that it differs from the American way of parenting, which is too loose and too individualistic. And she had great success in the Chinese way of parenting. Her children, she teaches at Yale, and her children also go to Ivy League schools. And it's not so much her book that caused controversy, but also the reception, because some of the press reports were like, this is why they're doing so well, or maybe she's right, maybe we shouldn't let our kids draw with so many crayons and do math workbooks. So we have Tiger Mom Amy Chua to Dreamer Jose Antonio Vargas. Jose Antonio Vargas is a well-known dreamer activist and an advocate for comprehensive immigration reform, but more broadly, an advocate for just a more humane, reasonable discussion about immigration. He is an undocumented immigrant himself from the Philippines. He calls himself an undocumented American. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and he has an organization called Define American that I urge you all to look at. Asian Americans include those who have just arrived today, as well as those whose families have been in the United States for several generations. They are working class families who struggle to make ends meet, as well as professionals with multiple advanced degrees, passports, and homes. Some embrace the model minority label, while others actively work to dispel it. Their multi-ethnic and multiracial families are headed by same-sex parents, single parents, and grandparents. They are adoptees, refugees, immigrants, naturalized citizens, undocumented immigrants, and U.S.-born Americans. They symbolize stories of American success and privilege, as well as struggle and poverty. As diverse as they are part of a larger Asian American community that, through its complexity, uniquely captures the story of America. Theirs is a history of immigrant dreams, American realities, and global connections that helped to make the United States what it is today. And as the fastest growing group in the country, Asian Americans are also helping to create the nation that will be in the future.
We've reached one of the best parts of the Fireside series, the Q&A with the author and our dedicated audience at Hamlin Midway Library. It's a chance to go beyond the book, connecting readers and writers on a deeper level. To make it easier for you, the listener, I summarize the questions and we'll read them. Can Lee describe the kinship or lack thereof between different segments of the Asian American community, whether it be ethnic or generational?
So you are talking about 20 million people, so it's going to be extremely diverse, and it's going to be to depend, right? But I'll share a couple of anecdotes. So one is, take that World War II period. Japan is a rising empire during World War II. It has invaded China, the Philippines. It has already annexed Korea. So within the Asian American community, within the US, there is a lot of anti-Japanese hostility. It's more complicated in that many of those Asian Americans are mistaken for Japanese as well. And so there is very little solidarity across ethnic groups before the 1960s, frankly. You have Chinese Americans wearing buttons saying Chinese, not Japanese. You have Filipino Americans willingly taking over the land that Japanese Americans had to vacate once they were incarcerated. Korean Americans refused to let the Japanese government lobby on their behalf in any diplomatic sense. They explicitly wanted to be seen as a sovereign country. So pan-ethnic solidarities are very, especially in that case, you know, in the 1930s and 40s, is very limited. By the 1960s, a new generation, second, third generation college students are finally mingling with each other out of the hoods, out of the ethnic enclaves, politicized, working together in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement and women's liberation. And they're realizing that, oh, there's another Asian face here. And frankly, you know, I'm working as part of the women's liberation movement, but there are issues specific to my community. And maybe it's time that we work together. And so this is the birth of the Asian American label, a pan-ethnic consciousness and pan-ethnic solidarity. Now, the generation question is interesting, too. I talk about how there are at least two Asian Americas. One that is before 1965, the 65 Immigration Act is the one that really opened up the United States to all of the new immigration that we've seen in the last 50 years, and a pre-65 and a post-65. And my mother has sort of witnessed these changes close, very, you know, closely. So she grew up American first, Chinese second, American, you know. And she's in a retirement community in California. It's very large. She always would hang out with the Japanese American, the Nisei. She felt like they got her, that, you know, Asian American. And she started hanging out in the Chinese American club, but then I'd get these weekly phone calls, and there were always these complaints, you know. First it was, you know, all the new immigrants from Shanghai, they just stick together and they speak Shanghainese. And then more recently is, Now they're leading the meetings in Mandarin, and she doesn't speak Mandarin, you know, or Shanghainese. And she said I had to ask them to speak in English, you know. And she's a little annoyed. And I'm sort of cringing, going, oh God, you know, you're not going to be one of those, you know, English only people, you know. but I can, you know, I'm her daughter, so I have to say, that's too bad, Mom. But it's very interesting because she's seeing these, you know, Chinese America, there's no Chinese America, and one Chinese America anymore. The Chinese America that my family is from, we're smaller in number. And the experience, the Angel Island experience, probably doesn't resonate with people who are more recently arrived. Or they might think of it as an unfortunate chapter in history that has nothing to do with them and doesn't potentially need to be remembered, or is sort of shameful and we don't want to acknowledge it because it, you know, we're trying to focus on making sure that we're accepted. So it's definitely a challenge.
Does Lee's book talk about Chinese adoption and issues surrounding Americans adopting children from Asian countries?
So one of the fascinating transitions that we see, it happens during World War II and the Cold War. World War II, I talked a little bit about the changing attitudes. Obviously, with World War II and the Cold War, the U.S. is fully engaged in Asia. We are, our U.S. servicemen are in Japan, Okinawa, Korea, and with their presence comes the first mixed race children born of U.S. servicemen who were abandoned by both governments. And in Korea, we see the beginnings of a humanitarian crisis, which becomes publicized through church groups and social service agencies about children born of U.S. fathers who have been abandoned by their mothers and by their communities, as well as their fathers. And in this Cold War context, the United States, there's more of a willingness to engage internationally. to take ownership of that responsibility, especially if we're trying to send the message globally that the U.S. is a democracy, all races are equal, and those of you who are thinking about going to the communist side, you want to look to us as an example. We really need to walk the walk as well as talk the talk. So there's the beginnings of transracial, transnational Korean adoption slowly, but then it turns into a more wide scale, and some scholars call it a business, more institutionalized. And it's because of that history that Chinese international adoption begins to take place, as well as from Guatemala, Ethiopia as well. We are that generation of Chinese adoptees are just entering adulthood. So there's the beginning of scholarship and the voices from their own experiences as well. So it will be interesting to see how that history gets written and told and shared.
What happened to Japanese American property after internment during World War II?
Some Japanese Americans were able to turn to their neighbors and ask them to take care of their farms. The vast majority were forced to sell during a fire sale, you know, so massive loads of farm equipment and land and the crops. It was particularly ironic because it was a really good strawberry and asparagus crop that was coming up, and they were forced to leave before harvest time. And so you lost all of that year's labor and equipment. So the vast majority had to sell pennies to the dollar, but there are some cases of caretakers and others who, you know, would come and visit families in the camp, send supplies and other things, especially teachers who would come and teach in the camp. So there's a little bit of both, but in terms of equipment and farmland, most of it was lost.
Given that immigration exclusion policies often discriminated against women, can Lee comment on how this discrimination contributed to the human trafficking and forced sex trade of Chinese women after the Civil War?
So it was a bachelor society in the U.S., but many were actually married transnationally, right? So the gender ratio for Chinese and most Asian American communities is highly skewed. There are small numbers of Chinese women who start coming over in the 1920s and 30s, and it's both because things are changing in China, it's more acceptable for Chinese women to travel, as well as things changing in the United States. But there is both a large-scale business of Chinese sex workers that cater to both Chinese and non-Chinese communities in the West Coast. But it starts to dwindle down, especially with progressive era reforms and others. There's a well-known rescue house, the Protestant Mission Home in San Francisco, that was a place, a known place, where Chinese women, if they could escape, could go to and escape abusive husbands. And typically the prostitutes are the ones who are the least powerful and did not have the means to even, you know, leave their surroundings. But the Protestant Mission Home was responsible for helping a good number of women move on to other things. So I would greatly recommend Unbound Feet by my colleague Judy Young. So Unbound Feet, and it's a history of Chinese women in San Francisco, and looks at the transition of Chinese immigrant and Chinese American women from, you know, she has unbound feet, taking first steps, you know, in stride, you know, and it's an excellent social history and very readable.
Finally, can Lee comment on the intersection of contemporary Asian American activism and the idea of the model minority and the broader history of Asian Americans as social activists?
So I was on a panel a few weeks ago. It's always a challenge. We were taking questions from social media, and one of the questions was, where are all the Asian American activists? And I was on a panel with two other people, and the other two people answered first. And they said, yeah, they're nowhere to be found. I think it must be in our culture. We're just not taught to be outspoken and to really fight. And they talked along, and I was getting visibly angry. But I said in my nice way, I said, you know, I just have to respectfully disagree. We have a long history of challenging discrimination, all, you know, in the streets, all the way up to the Supreme Court. I talked about the Wong Kim-ark birthright citizenship case in 1898. I talked about long records of interracial, cross-racial, pan-ethnic organizing, whether it be in the plantations or in the sweatshops or on, you know, the buses going down to Montgomery, you know, and I just said, it's a problem that we just don't know our history, and that we believe the media message about Asian Americans being the model minority, and this is a real problem. I do find that, again, going on this theme about how Asian Americans are illuminate how race works, take two issues. Immigration is considered a Latino issue. Asian Americans are nowhere to be found in these debates, even though Chinese are the largest immigrant group coming in, and Asian Americans make up the fastest growing population of undocumented immigrants, but nowhere to be seen. And when I write op-eds or when I give interviews and I make these points, sometimes the comments come back and it glosses right over the Asian American issues and then goes straight to the, we need to keep all the Mexican rapists out of the United States. So it's this interesting, like, just a feedback loop that keeps on jumping over Asian Americans. But the work of groups like Asian Americans for Black Lives is especially important. I've read the manifesto. Many friends and colleagues, you know, are involved in the movement, and the rationale is that this affects all of us, and we need to be involved and in alliance. So it's important work. But it's also important to think about, you know, where is it that we do pop up and where is it that we don't pop up, and what work does that do? So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the second season of the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. Next week, Ojibwe historian and linguist Anton Troyer presents his latest work, Warrior Nation, A History of the Red Lake Ojibwe, a fascinating history which offers not only a chronicle of the Red Lake Nation, but also a compelling perspective on a difficult piece of U.S. history. Until then, we hope you consider supporting the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library and its mission, Stronger Libraries for Stronger Communities. Learn more at thefriends.org. Follow us on Twitter @thefriends and on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofsppl. Please consider subscribing to this podcast on iTunes. Thanks for listening.